I guess we got to take a car now.
I guess so.
Thank you so much for being here, guys. I'm Steve Rosen. We're here today to talk about bicycle cases. We're going to all introduce ourselves. We're going to take you in bicycle cases from intake all the way through non-economic damages. We could cover a lot of this in one panel per subtopic. So we're going to kind of move through things really relatively quickly. Like I said, I'm Steve Rosen. I own Rosen Law Offices. I also have a nonprofit that's Safe Bikeways that reports dangerous conditions. There's an app, we'll talk about it in a minute. This is Danielle Lingord. If you don't know her, she's brilliant. Over $150 million so far this year in settlements, $67 million, $38 million, a $10 million bicycle case. She's going to talk about non-economic damages. But introduce yourself. I'm sorry, I'm bragging about you.
What else is there to say? Hi everyone, like you said, Danielle and Forrest work at the Holland Core Law Firm. I'm gonna be probably talking about towards the end, so I encourage everyone to stay around. Don't forget that I'll be speaking afterwards, thanks.
Hi, I'm Miles Cooper. I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm with Cooper's LLP. About 70% of the cases that we handle are bicycle cases. We do everything from property damage all the way up to fatalities and some trial work along the way.
I'm Dr. Yogi Patel, pain management in all of the San Diego area.
I'm Dr. John Austin, I'm an orthopedic surgeon in the San Diego area.
That's who we are. All right, so I said we'd start with intake. One of the kind of themes you're gonna get here are cyclists are typically kind of different type of people. And there's a lot of things that we do in intake to kind of figure out our clients. You want to do, of course, the basic facts surrounding the loss, casual rider, or are they a cyclist? I'm going to be talking about tools in discovery that you can get to prove damages and actually help with liability arguments as well. But whether or not they're a road cyclist or a casual biker, that usually makes quite a difference. We'll send you our PowerPoint. We're slide intensive, so don't worry about writing anything down or taking pictures. Just email us and we'll do it. UIM insurance, I'll touch on. If you don't know, cyclists are covered as long as they're hit by a motor vehicle. So I always, at the beginning, find out their own insurance. And if you have a friend that is a road cyclist, they will eventually get hit. So go tell them to have good UIM coverage, please. We're gonna talk about liability. Fault on police reports usually stink, we'll get into that. So here's some kind of cool stuff that I wanted to touch on. These are unique tools for finding comparative fault and proving damages. There's bike computers, mobile apps, video, and then the community. And I'll touch on each of these separately, but having a cyclist as a client is having almost a guaranteed black box, okay? You can find out so much data from a regular cyclist. And I'm not talking about an unfortunate situation where a child's riding a bike and gets hit by a car or whatnot. I'm talking about road cyclists. The information you can get from them is absolutely amazing. So I'll get right into it. Bike computers, everybody's heard of a Garmin, right? So Garmin's, the technology has developed incredibly. This is some of the stuff that you can get just by asking for their Garmin data. So I'm gonna tell you the theme's gonna be get it all right away. So if right when you're doing the intake, hey, did you have a Garmin on you? Usually it's on the handlebars or on a watch, right? Get all that data right away. And I'm gonna talk about Strava and get that as well. But some of the stuff that you can get from it and get from the mobile apps I'm gonna talk about, location, route, duration, speed, elevation, grade, and comparable rides, completely separate stuff. One of the issues, I like to tell a story about a client that I had that came in and a police report basically said the wrong location. It happened over here at a really bad intersection. Over here is where the cyclist unfortunately was brought by some people, and then the police respond and they find him over there and they think it's a different intersection and they put our cyclist at fault. What we're able to do is go into the Garmin and the Strava and pull the actual ride. And I'll get into that in a second, but you could see a loop, right? And the loop was like average 17 miles an hour. And then all of a sudden there's this little cut over and that's like 2 miles an hour, right? And then there's a big straight line and that's like 50 miles an hour. So what did I get from that? It's a basic story, right? He's on his ride, gets hit by a car, he stops there, then he's getting walked over 5 miles an hour, and then he's getting driven off by an ambulance. And I was able to show all of that by just pulling the Garmin and Strava data. Comparable rides I'll get into in a minute, but it's like having somebody that runs marathons or whatnot. You're getting an athlete that you can look at really what was their life like in their practice, in their athletics prior to and after, and you can tell that story, okay? Other than that, so here's Strava. Garmin Connect's also really rad. Map My Ride's getting more popular. We'll send this all to you. You see some of the stuff that it'll show, the routes, right, the average speeds. Strava Flyby is rad, and you can ask Miles about it because he's done it better than I have. But basically what it has is when you're using Strava and you go on for that day, you can see other people that took that same route that same day. So think about that. You have potential witnesses, okay, that you can go on and you can find and you can DM through this social media app. Who uses Strava here? Does anybody? Yeah, it's common. I mean, if you run, bike, swim, people typically have it. Videos are becoming more popular. Public, private videos. I will, if I have a dangerous condition case, I'll go out there, we'll pull video off of a buildings. I have a case in Laguna Beach, pulled video off a building. 1 week later, found out that another cyclist found hit that same dangerous condition and went down. Both brain injuries with 1 week apart, and we get video both from the business right there. So it was really cool. I also have a group ride. I have this case with Taylor Ernst where one of the group riders had a helmet, GoPro, and you see our guy hit a dangerous condition and go down and smack his head. And let me tell you, it's something. So go get that video. And community help is a really, really great one. This is the last thing I'm gonna talk about. Were you riding with the group? First thing I asked, were you riding solo? Do you normally go on this route? All this fun stuff. If not, if it's a Saturday, and I know it's a common place, like Newport Back Bay or something in Orange County, I will go to local bike shops and look up local rides online, and I will find people that were riding on that route that day to look for witnesses as well. It works great. Safe Bikeways, I'm gonna plug. We started this nonprofit. What we do is we record dangerous conditions. People submit it, it's an app, you can get it on Apple Store. And you record a dangerous condition, and then we report it to the municipality. So you can come to us if you have a dangerous condition case and say, hey, have you ever reported this or something similar within the city, and we'll help you out. So thank you so much. That's kind of my part, I think, right? Oh, no, sorry. Last thing, USA Race results. This is real. This is somebody you can go on. Just Google USA Cycling Race results if you have an avid cyclist. I'm going to trial in this week, and their big thing is your guy rode a race 4 days later. I can go on and show his race results up to, and then how crappy he did 4 days after this event as well. They can also get this. They'll just go on. It's all public. If your guy rides for USA Cycling, he has a license number. That's the easiest way, but you can also search it by name. And then all of this stuff, I wrote an article, it's back there. I know I'm rushing through things. Grab it or email me and I'll give you more information. Miles.
Thank you.
Down.
Down.
Harold.
You too.
Steve mentioned the flybys, and I'll just do a quick piece on that. We had a case where the liability was contested, and the only person who was there to talk about it was the driver. By using Strava flybys, we were able to find a couple of cyclists who had been by the location, and had actually seen it, but not had an opportunity to stop. Officer hadn't been interested in taking their statement. Obviously, cyclists like cyclists, and while they're probably not going to lie, they're going to be biased in favor of the cyclists. So flybys is an incredibly powerful tool to help connect the dots when you've got a liability issue in a case. So turning to this slide right now, anyone who's ever handled a bicycle case, what's wrong with this picture? What is an adjuster or a juror going to say, exactly, no helmet? So I want to talk a little bit about the lens, though. If you talk to a cyclist, what would a cyclist say is wrong with this picture? This goof is wearing spandex on a mountain bike. He's using a late model mountain bike. It's 26-inch, not a 27-plus. And what the heck is he doing with a suspension fork out on that road? And so the reason I focus on this is it's all about the lens. And on the lens, most of your jurors, definitely all your adjusters, are going to be people who have a windshield view of the issue. What's a windshield view? They spend 90% of their time behind a windshield. Same with the cops. The cops who show up and investigate are going to be looking at this from the view of a windshield. So, the first thing you're going to want to do is question authority. Whatever is in that police report is going to be wrong. I guarantee it. And the reason it's going to be wrong is because the cops don't know the vehicle code. And the cops certainly don't know the Muni code. So, another trick question. Is it legal to ride on a sidewalk in California? Anyone? No? Yes? Maybe? Depends. And the answer is, it totally depends. And the reason it totally depends is, it's governed by the Muni code, not by the vehicle code. So, yes, you can ride on a sidewalk as long as the municipality has not come along and enacted a rule that says you can't. And within a city, so I live in San Francisco, my kid can ride on a sidewalk, I can't. You go to San Jose, you can ride on some of the sidewalks, but not the sidewalks in the downtown corridor. Why is this important? Because the cops oftentimes will put your cyclist at fault because they've been riding on a sidewalk as they go into an intersection, and obviously you can't be on a sidewalk, therefore you're at fault. So one of the first things you're going to be doing is questioning the liability finding in a case because you're going to have to be dealing with it. Even though we all know that the officer's finding is not admissible at trial, you're going to have to deal with the adjuster who's putting the value on the case. Go next. So 70% of the cases you're going to be dealing with are going to be motor vehicle incidents. Another 25% typically are going to be premises cases. So great, right? So this actually is a grate that was installed at the parking lot under the De Young Museum within the last 2 years. So most of the grate cases don't exist anymore because Caltrans and NACDO and ASHTO, the governing agencies that do storm grates, have done a pretty good job of coming up with ways to make sure that they don't eat wheels anymore. However, you will still find cases where wheels get eaten. And you may, this then goes to the question, the premises. We had a case in South San Francisco. A young woman was riding to Genentech as a commuter. A car starts making a right-hand turn in front of her. She drifts to the right. She goes over the handlebars, has no idea what happened. Driver gets out, thinks she has hit the cyclist. She is so apologetic. Both driver and cyclist think this is what's going on. We pull the building camera footage nearby. There's an ATM that was perpendicular. What happened? As she drifted to the right, storm grate was out of compliance. It had been slid a little to the right. And so her wheel dropped into the storm grate and she had rotated over the front. This wasn't a vehicle case. This was a dangerous conditions case. And South San Francisco paid a significant amount of money that the young woman broke her jaw. And this is where cycling cases and Danielle's conversation will get interesting. She broke her jaw and 4 weeks later with her jaw wired shut, ran the Boston Marathon, because that's what our cycling clients do. Yeah. So on the premises side, you're going to want to be focused on potholes, storm grates, and the Sunshine Act. So for anyone who has not been using the Sunshine Act as their ready-made discovery weapon of choice, the Sunshine Act will get you everything that has ever happened, been reported, talked about, complained, from the traffic engineering department, from Ferrari, it's 311. People call in and make complaints about these things. And you'll get things like, you gotta fix this pothole that's right in front of my house. I saw a cyclist go down last week. It nearly killed him. Somebody else is going to be hurt really bad. We need to establish that notice piece. So with the Sunshine Act, you're going to find all sorts of wonderful things. And for those of you taking the PMK of somebody at the municipality later on, the Sunshine Act people never talk to the city attorneys for the most part. So I've been in depositions where, and backing up, I learned about the Sunshine Act midway through a case, was taking the deposition of the PMK. The PMK and the city agency gave me zero in the way of documents. I learned about the Sunshine Act, I asked for it. It was after my discovery had already been turned over. I started grilling this guy on the street paving index and why this road was at 65%, alligator cracking all over the place. They knew it should have been replaced. And the city attorney was apoplectic. Where did you get this? Like, your Sunshine Act department gave it to me 2 weeks ago when you didn't in discovery, because I was a little surprised that you didn't have any documents on this intersection. So remember the Sunshine Act when you're doing these types of cases on the premises side.
Can I say something about that? Because
yeah,
brilliant. So great cases to give you an example. Sunshine Act working. We did a public records request on a great case in that Metro owns the great. Four cyclists in the span of 3 weeks went down. We just like that, we'll go to the local police and ask for public records as well. We often get another bike accident where the police responded. So Miles is absolutely right. Utilize that. And they make you file government claims before you file a lawsuit. Ask, do a public record request within that 6 months.
So finally, the smallest fraction of cases that you're going to deal with in the cycling world are going to be product cases. I used to say that they were all carbon. Now they're all carbon and cheap e-bikes. And the joke, they're carbon-based death forms. I do ride some carbon. However, carbon is where we see some of our absolute worst cases come from. Worst meaning what's happened to the person. This picture is from a real incident. This was a Time bike, an early model Time. Look back when they laminated and glued. So you get carbon tubes and they'd go into lugs. And this be laminated when she was going 12 miles an hour and a small stick came up in her spoke as she rotated around. She found herself holding her handlebars on the ground and then picking up her teeth. The carbon cases are challenging because you're going to drop between 20 to 50 grand into the case before you know you have a case frequently. And one of the best ways to do that, if you have a good manufacturer, is to reach out to them at the beginning and say, look, we got a catastrophic incident. I don't want to go through a ton of discovery. Can we agree to a testing protocol where we can figure out if there actually is a void in this carbon? And backing up, what's a void? Because that's what you need to know about on the carbon cases. Carbon, my expert described it this way to me. Carbon is in essence like spaghetti, where with the spaghetti, you fill in glue in between. If you just have a bunch of spaghetti, dry spaghetti, it breaks easily. But when you fill in the stuff in between, it becomes incredibly strong. In your carbon cases, what you're looking for is, did the issue, that sudden breakaway of carbon, because carbon gives no warning, unlike steel, is that sudden breakaway caused by a crack that worked its way from the outside in which case it's your client's fault because they dropped the bike and didn't know about it or they had some previous crash, or is it a void? Is there a small space inside that carbon where a crack started working and kind of onioning its way out? And the only way you're going to be able to tell this is with some fine slicing and usually some CT imaging work. It's super expensive, it's worth it in the right case, and you'll oftentimes find that there is indeed a void. In a Bianchi case we did not too long ago, Bianchi couldn't even tell us what factory out of Taiwan this bike had been made at. And so you start learning, you know, how even these $10,000 bikes are pieces of shit when you make them in terms of the carbon. So the cheap e-bikes, you'll see a ton of these as well. It's mismatched parts. And oftentimes it'll be a long pole caliper with a short pole lever, meaning the e-bikes have to have special brake levers where as soon as you pull the brake lever, the motor cuts out, because otherwise the motor will keep going. The levers oftentimes don't match the back end, and they've gotten an $800 motor and a $2 brake to get a $1,000 e-bike. So what you find with a lot of your e-bike cases is that they are not well-made bicycles, and those are actually pretty easy cases to do because you don't need to spend 40 grand to do destructive testing to figure it out. I think that's it.
Will you give a minute on Doran cases?
Oh, Doran.
You do a lot of them.
Yeah. In the top five urban bicycle cases, Dorings are probably number one in terms of what's going to happen. And it's bad design. By bad design, it's They build the bike lanes right next to the parking lanes, and drivers are idiots, and they open the door and they fling the door right into traffic. And whether the cyclist gets hurt from the door or whether the cyclist gets hurt from the door, bounced into traffic and run over and killed, which unfortunately frequently happens. Doorings are super straightforward cases in that there is a vehicle code on point that says you cannot open a door into traffic. So when somebody opens a door, they become liable. Where you have issues with adjusters is they start arguing that the door was open for a while. And you'll also, again, find cops who will find your cyclist at fault, even though the dumb driver opened the door. Is that enough?
That's perfect. All right.
Thank you.
And hands to down this next slot.
So I'm Dr. Patel. So I started with disc slide intentionally. So again, I think TBI or head injuries is a very, very big part of bicycle injuries. About 25 to 50% of all bicycle injuries will have this. And I think even with the helmet. So, you know, obviously there's more, you know, more serious injuries like bleeds or fractures. But the point here is that TBI itself can present with a variety of symptoms. And as a provider and or intake manager, it's very important that we ask the client or the patient in detail these symptoms. My bigger colleague here, Dr. Paul Jane, manages a lot of TBI in the audience, and he'll attest to this, that patients will not tell you that they have these symptoms unless you ask them in detail. You have to, one by one, you have ringing in the ears, you have forgetfulness, you have moodiness. Once you start listing these different symptoms, they will then be able to connect those symptoms that they're experiencing to the injury. So again, this is a very important thing when you're managing individuals in any accident, but specifically bicycle accidents that you were screening for TBI. So I'm just gonna quickly go over just kind of the common injuries that we see in bicycle accidents. Obviously this is sometimes more damaging than those individuals in motor vehicle accidents, because a bicyclist doesn't have a protective metal box to protect them, you know? So facial injuries are very common. Eye trauma and dental injuries are very, very common, especially when you have the debris from the road flying into somebody's eye. So that's always very important to look for. Again, there's no protective shield that a bicyclist has on that protects them from their internal organs. So you can have lacerations of internal organs, rib damages, lung damages. And again, also genitourinary regions can be injured. You need to ask your patients about sexual dysfunction. They may be not upfront about talking about that, but a good review system is going to be important, especially in these type of patients, because again, they're not going to connect their injuries or their symptoms to the injuries unless you go into in detail. We all know about myofascial, skin abrasions, contusions, scars. We take scars lightly sometimes, but for some individuals, scars is a big mental stress for them, and it's important that we recognize that and not just blow off scars as well. My colleague here, Dr. Austin, is gonna kind of touch base on all the orthopedic injuries. I'm more of an interventional pain guy, so I'm gonna focus on the spine injuries. I put CRPS here just to kind of bring to people's attention, not that the CRPS is from the bicycle injury, but a lot of these individuals suffer broken bones, have to undergo surgery, and sometimes they don't heal or respond to treatment as expected. So we should always, as providers, keep in the back of our mind, if an individual is not progressing, not responding to therapy, not recovering from surgery, are they developing a very, very bad disease called CRPS, which we don't have time to go into, but yeah, everybody should be aware of this. Okay, so again, the one thing, just with the mental screening questions, when doing an examination, you have to ask patients individual body parts. Every time I ask my patient, where are you hurt? They're gonna tell me the main one. My head hurts, my neck hurts, but if you don't ask in detail, how's your elbow, how's your knee, how's your wrist, how's your hand, they won't tell you. Once you ask that, they're gonna say, oh yeah, my elbow's a little sore. So this is where you need to, you know, ask and evaluate for all the deep soft tissue injuries as well, because again, those are important. Me being a pain physician, obviously I'm always focused on the spine. And I think that this is an area that I think a lot of case managers, attorneys, and patients have a tough time understanding what exactly are the spine injuries and how do we help them. And so I try to explain to patients to make it simple that, you know, think of their spine as three layers. The muscle layer that kind of supports the spine, the joints that help us move, and obviously the discs that support our spine as well. You often see, you know, recommendations from physicians involving epidurals. That seems to be the most common. And why is that? Because epidurals here or a result, or I'm sorry, epidurals or steroid injections, we typically use those because when somebody has a significant impact and sustains a disc herniation, as you can see there, this has a pointer to. It's okay. Well, you can see that disc herniation there on the left. So you can see what happens, it's like a jelly donut, and that disc herniates and causes a lot of irritation. You can see the redness on that nerve root, and that is very, very painful. That will make a grown man cry, just like pain taxes. So it is very, very uncomfortable. And that's why, you know, even though an individual may sustain multiple injuries to the spine, we focus on epidurals initially. And again, on the right there, you see some of the facet joints of the low back. And those all obviously can get injured. Typically, people call that whiplash, the ligaments, things like that. And again, when I try to explain people, a lot of times the patient will say, "Well, I don't want a small, I don't want an injection. It's only going to give me temporary relief. I want to fix." You know. And again, the idea here is this was typically a normal individual, didn't have chronic pain, didn't have any type of pain, has this trauma, and now has significant inflammation, unable to. Go back to normal activities, sometimes very severe pain. And the purpose of our treatment is to reduce the inflammation. None of my injections can fix the disc herniation. I can't fix the tears. But if I can reduce the inflammation, I can hopefully help them heal faster and better. And so the way I describe them is I tell them, look, think of yourself as a forest. This injury has resulted in a few large fires in your forest. My injection is a plane of water. My epidural is a plane of water. That steroid injection, steroid medication is that water. I'm gonna dump that water on your fire. I'm gonna put your fire out. And what you have left over is burnt wood. But the forest can't rebuild unless we get that inflammation gone. So we need to reduce everything we can with conservative therapy, even injection therapy, anything we can do to reduce the inflammation so then whatever's left over, all that burnt wood can rebuild into a new forest. Unfortunately, the human body is not so good at recovering 100%. So this is the same thing for the neck, same idea, how we look at joint whiplash type pain and also disc herniations and the goal to reducing the redness. When you hear a lot of confusion when attorneys often ask you, what is a facet, what's the MBB? The terminology for facets, a facet injection, there's different ways to treat them. You can inject into the facet, so a facet injection. A medial branch block, also referring to facet treatment. Radiofrequency ablation is the cauterization of those branches of the nerves that go to the facet. So when you hear these terminologies, you're dealing with facets. And I often tell people that typically a facet or joint pain tends to be axial, doesn't tend to radiate as much. But when things start shooting down the arm, shooting down the legs, you get numbness and weakness, or even shooting to the shoulder blade, we're looking for disc herniation. And again, individuals will have multiple injuries together. And so last thing I'm gonna talk about here real quickly is, again, unlike a person driving a car, a cyclist doesn't have the protection of a metal box there. And so often when they get hit and thrown onto a very hard pavement, they will sustain spinal cord injuries. And those are very, very devastating. Depending on where the injury is, will determine if the patient ends up quadriplegic, paraplegic, you know, and so it's very important to have a good neuro exam looking for any weakness, numbness, any bladder dysfunction. Those things are very good, so this is very unfortunate. So that covers my injuries. I'm gonna hand it off to Dr. Austin here.
Good afternoon, I'm John Austin. I'm an orthopedic surgeon right here in San Diego. I've been tasked with talking with you with some of these extremity injuries in cyclists. So as our panelists have alluded, there's more and more cyclists with each passing year, 80 million in the US. We've talked about some professional cyclists. Now we see these e-bikes with children going to school, four of them pass my house every 5 minutes at 8 a.m. They're on their cell phone, by the way, going 30 miles an hour. So are the Teslas, by the way, driving the other way. They're on their screen. So there's a lot changing with these e-cycles in the space right now. As of 2020, according to the National Safety Council, over 300,000 cycling injuries, most not serious. Obviously, some are very serious. The other panelists have talked about this at length. What are the circumstances of the accident? Helmet, where device is a factor. Devices are becoming a factor on both sides of this equation more and more. Just yesterday morning, I saw some kid going to school. On his phone, Tesla going by on their phone, it's just unbelievable. So lots of devices coming into play, screens coming into play, night factors, reflectors, lights, clothing, all this affects liability, road conditions, we talked about that, distracted drivers, rather obvious. Regarding orthopedic injuries, there's a severity beginning with cuts, which are relatively minor, very common, up to more serious lacerations involving the subcutaneous tissue, which is the fat tissue, into the myofascial ligamentous tissue, which is the outer packaging around your muscles, right and down to bone, nerve, artery, so they can be relatively minor, they can be very serious, I've seen them all. Bruises and hematomas, again, there's a big hematoma in the upper right there of the thigh, that's probably a unit of blood in somebody's thigh, your thigh can have 2 units of blood in it, and if it's subcutaneous, it's fine, if it goes intramuscular, it can be a compartment syndrome, we'll talk about that a little bit. It's a great case if that happens and you're an attorney and there's liability. Myofascial injuries, tendon injuries. So remember, basic orthopedics, tendon connects muscle to bone. So your quadriceps tendon connects your quadriceps muscle to your patella and ultimately your tibial tubercle. Ligament injuries connect bone to bone. So your anterior cruciate ligament connects bone to bone. Fractures, we'll talk about that. Compartment syndrome, it's a surgical emergency. It's the number one reason orthopedic surgeons are sued in the ER, missed compartment syndrome. I've released many compartments back when I took ER call. I don't take it anymore, thank God. TBI, we've alluded to that. Spinal cord injuries, rare but serious. Of course, death. Compartment syndrome, most common in your leg, your tibia, if you will. There's 4 compartments. I won't bore you with the medicine, but basically if you have that hematoma develop within your muscle, the fascia surrounding that muscle can only expand so far. And if that muscle swells enough due to inflammation, bleeding, it can cut off the blood supply to nerves and blood vessels in that compartment. You're in the deep posterior compartment, the red compartment in that leg lies your posterior tibial artery and your tibial nerve. If that compartment stays swollen for 24 hours, you have a permanent neurologic injury. I've seen it, unfortunately. That compartment has to be urgently released within 24 hours or there's permanent neurologic and possible vascular injury. I've seen those not released, and I've seen them released whenever you get that call. You need to be very aggressive about releasing that ASAP. That's when I'm saying, clear the OR now. We are not waiting. Those are a big thing we got to think about. And this is a compartment syndrome in the leg in the upper left. You see it's tense and swollen. This is not a time for minimally invasive surgery. This is a time for big incisions and complete releases. You're saving their leg. And if that's missed, it can be a big deal. These are cases we routinely involve plastic surgeons and vascular surgeons. There's a lot of morbidity, even if they're successfully released. You can see in the lower left, this gentleman had bilateral leg compartment fasciotomies. He saved his leg, but you can see those scars. There's significant concavities, significant scarring. There's a lot of morbidity, even when they're successfully released in time. Regarding fractures, of course, that's what everyone thinks of when you think of orthopedics. This is a study last year out of the Archives of Orthopedic Trauma Surgery. They looked at all the cyclists. This was study was out of England, but the same data applies to the United States. You can see lower limb, the neck of the femur, extends to your hip bone, femoral shaft, tibial shaft, most common lower extremity injuries in cyclists. Older cyclists are more at risk than younger cyclists. They have more body mass. Their bones, they're more likely to have a little osteoporosis. They're just more likely to break stuff. Regarding upper extremity injuries, you can see in the upper right, that's a displaced clavicle shaft fracture with a vertical medial butterfly fragment. Clavicle is the most common bone broken in the upper extremity by far in cycling injuries. I've fixed a number of them from cycling injuries. We'll show you how we fix them in the next slide. That would get a surgery with me, and your clavicle is your only osseous connection from your whole forequartered arm to your thorax, so that's why it tends to break. It's also right there. It's subcutaneous, so it's right there. It doesn't take a lot of force to break it. Your radius is your wrist, essentially. That's in the middle left there. Your radius is the bone in your forearm on the thumb side of your forearm. Your ulna is that skinny one on the pinky side of your forearm. You can see your radius covers most of your wrist there, so that's why it tends to break when you have a Fuchs injury, which is a fall onto an outstretched hand. And that happens if you don't go over the handlebars, you go off the side, and guess what? You put your arm out, you break something. This is how we treat these injuries. Femoral shaft here in the lower left gets an intramedullary nail with proximal distal unlocking screws. In short, we put a little rod down their bone through small incisions, minimizes soft tissue stripping and further morbidity. Unfortunately, with the clavicle and wrist fractures, we can't do that. We can get those in through smaller incisions, but that gets a plate screw construct. The distal radius fracture, the tech's amazing. There's locking screws now. So the screws heads actually have threads that lock into the plate, which allow us to do a lot more surgery with a lot worse fractures than we used to with some less invasive techniques. And that's all I have.
Hi, everyone. As I introduced myself earlier, Danielle Lindquist, I work at the Holland and Poor Law Firm. And why are liability and injuries so important? Because we need damages. We take these cases on to make our clients whole. That's what damages are. If you, in the eyes of the law, the only way that we can provide our injured clients or the family that had suffered a loss is monetary damages. And so that's what we have to do. And then the question is, how much are these things worth? So as attorneys, we seek justice. In seeking justice, we have to make our clients whole. We don't want to make them 50% whole. We don't want to make them 75% whole. We want them to be 100% whole. So how do we do that? So when you have a wrongful death case, I've often hear people say, oh man, if they survived this, you know, the value of this case would have been so much higher. If they just lived, if I have a personal injury TBI case, that is worth so much more than a wrongful death case. That's not true. That's not true at all. Just this year, we've had multiple wrongful death cases. We've had multiple wrongful death cases that went to verdict last year exceeding $30 million. We had a three-year-old toddler riding a big wheel out in the street, ran over by a car. He did not survive. The question is, how much money is the loss of a mother's love? How do you argue that? How do you argue that? It's admitted liability. So none of the bad facts come out. Nobody hears anything about it other than this mom lost her son. How much is that worth? If you don't know how much that is worth, you need to do your homework. Not just for you, but you need to educate the defense. You need to educate the insurance representative and ask people, how much are you getting on these types of cases? When's the last time that you tried a case on these particular facts and what did you get? We do that at the Holland and Poor Law Firm all the time. Hey, Gary, hey, Brian, what did you get on this case? Can you send us your three top cases in this category with these facts? And then share that information. You have to know what your case is about in order to get full value for your case. Again, you want to make the clients 100% whole, and you have to know how to do that. Let's talk about another case, cycling case. Our client was an attorney, a very well-known white-collar criminal defense attorney. And he's just casually walking around or cycling around his neighborhood, hit by a car. The helmet literally fractures, $300 helmet. He suffers a mild TBI. He's still trying cases. And he's probably the smartest guy in the room. So during his deposition, you have several defense attorneys, you have plaintiff attorneys, and he was definitely by far, still after sustaining this mild brain injury, the smartest guy in the room. He even was more fit than anyone else in the room. He would go to the gym with a personal trainer every single day. So he's still trying cases, he's working out, he looks good, he presents well. What do I do with this case? How do I prove that this guy sustained a mild traumatic brain injury? So, you know, you have to meet him. You have to figure out what are his losses. And it wasn't just a brain injury case. It was also PTSD. You never forget PTSD cases. Your clients are not going to know if they have PTSD. They're not going to volunteer to you, especially a guy that he thinks he's the guy of guys, manly guy. He's not going to admit that he has a fear. He's not going to tell you, oh, I avoid this because it's scary, or that these things happen to me. No one's going to admit that. Part of being a good lawyer is to know the good questions to ask your clients. It's knowing which experts to go send your clients to so that they can assess them to make sure that all of their injuries or potential injuries are addressed. Otherwise, you can't make your client whole. So he was an avid cyclist. Every single day, he would go out and start cycling. And whether it was just for a couple miles around his neighborhood 10 times, or whether he spent an entire day cycling around. And I asked him, can you still ride a bike? Yes, he can still physically ride a bike. He can sit on the wheel, or he can sit on the seat, he can pedal those pedals, he can pedal the pedals. And he's like, but I can't do it anymore because I'm scared. I cannot ride a bike outside. He's like, I bought a Peloton. He's like, I can do that just fine. I still do it, but it's not the same. My entire life, I grew up cycling around, driving my bicycle around. That's what I love to do. That's made me me. That was my identity. I associated as being a cyclist. And I'm like, okay, but you can still ride a bike. Yes. You still do Peloton. Yes. Okay. And you still try cases. Yes. Okay. What do you do with this case? We ended up getting policy limits, 10.25 million. Know the value of your case. You have to understand the injuries. You have to humanize them. Let's say we hear people on the news every day of someone dying. It doesn't affect us. It doesn't affect us at all. But if you get a phone call that you just heard a loved one pass away, that's gonna change your life. That's gonna change your life forever. Because you can associate memories, you can associate feelings, and you can associate just how much better this world was because that person was here. You have to humanize the person that died. You have to humanize your client, and you have to share that with the defense if you want to settle your case. They said down, but I'm not sure which way it is. Okay. So, in knowing the value of your case, don't forget the jury instructions. We'll use the jury instructions all the time during trial. We try to use it in opening if we're allowed to. We always use it in closing. Refer to it. Let your clients know what it is. Know what you can be compensated for. Break it all up. The loss of love. How much money is the cost of a hug from your mom? How much would you pay to have one more text message from your dad that says, I am proud of you? How much money would you pay to be able to have one more Thanksgiving? You can't forget these little things. There's some cases where we ask the entire family, send us your best memories, put it on video, write it down. And then you know what? We have 50 people telling their stories that we put in a mediation brief so the other side can see what kind of person this is. That when this comes out at trial, they're gonna be paying a lot of money, millions and millions of dollars. PTSD, again, some of our biggest cases are just PTSD cases. And those cases, the clients don't tell you, you have to look for it. I get very passionate about my cases. If anyone knows me, they will tell you that I get very possessive over my cases. I believe that as truth seekers, that as justice seekers, we have not only an honor, but a duty to our clients to be the best attorney that we can for them. I heard a lot of people saying throughout this conference, other conferences, you have to have a good client. Your client has to be likable. Sometimes we can't change who our client is, but you can decide who you are. Having a good attorney, being able to put down the work, being able to be passionate about each and every case, knowing that it's our job and our duty to seek justice and pursue it one case at a time, one client at a time, and just make sure that we seek and get entire full justice, which means, again, 100% of the value of the case. And if you don't know what that value is, please ask. Inform yourself and inform everyone else. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. So we covered two or three things. So if anyone has questions to follow up on anything, we're happy to answer whatever questions you have. We can go back to slides. You can get these slides. You can email me at steve@cyclinglaw.com, and we'll give them to you. But do anybody have any questions for any of us? Yes. Hi.
When your client doesn't have a helmet on, how do you get over that stigma with a fail buster and the next turn?
I think we can all kind of talk about that, but I yell at my client first. I'm kind of like a dad first before I'm a lawyer, but it happens. You buy it. You're just honest. I mean, we can all tell you how to respond to bad facts and stuff. I think everybody's going to tell you the best way to respond is say, yeah, we'll acknowledge that. We'll acknowledge he made a mistake. He's human. And there's still this issue. So anything else with that?
Yeah, first of all, it comes up in 100% of cases. Meaning if your client is not wearing a helmet, it gets raised. And I mean, if you really want to go nuts, read the comments on any article involving a cyclist. Was the person wearing a helmet? There was a child who was run over by a gravel truck in Campbell. His head was run over by a gravel truck. And the questions were, was he wearing a helmet? Wouldn't have made a fucking bit of difference. It was a gravel truck. And yet that's what you're seeing in the comments. So most cases, helmet doesn't make a difference. Like all these collarbone wrist cases, helmet doesn't make a difference. So the response to that is, why are we talking about this? Yeah, how would a helmet have made a difference here? Ms. Adjuster, tell me how a helmet would make a difference. Jurors, tell me how a helmet would have made a difference. Why is that important to you? Well, it's important because, you know, maybe they were careless. Well, it doesn't matter. So the other piece is, and different lawyers have had different success with this, is keeping it out on motion in limine. If it's not relevant to the fact pattern, they don't get it. There are also people who have been successful on keeping it out because it is not required. If you're under 18, you have to wear a helmet in California. Over 18, there's no law on that. So again, you go to that eggshell plaintiff, the driver takes the cyclist, the way they were found. So there are various tactics that you can use to try and overcome it. The final one is to use a biomechanist and a neurologist to start talking about how the helmet would have not really made a difference because helmets are crap anyway.
Anything else? We're here. All right.
Before we're done.
Yeah, please.
I'm guessing folks can tell that the people up here are passionate about these types of cases. So one thing, I'll speak for myself, but I'm guessing everyone is going to say yes as well. We want the best results for cycling clients across the boards. We love spitballing these types of cases. Reach out to us. A 10-minute phone call can make the difference between getting a policy and getting a $2,000 offer on a case sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely.
We discussed the issue of police reports and civil law, how they place the cyclists on all the sidewalk. How about the issue of riding on the opposite side of the road?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I mean, maybe you can talk to that. So I want to touch on a couple of those things because we skipped over them really quickly. Police reports, 70% of my cases, 80% of my cases are cycling cases. Of those, 70 to 80% the police reports are bad for us. I have cases where cyclist is in a bike lane going straight, well within the speed limit, and someone takes a left turn and T-bones them. And I still get a police report that puts them 50% at fault for not watching out or whatever the cop decides to do it. Police reports are not great for cyclists. So I kind of wanted to touch on that. And we talk to our cycling clients about that, about the police reports.
What was the actual question?
The actual question was, what happens when you've got a person running on the sidewalk going the opposite way of traffic?
Yeah, so sidewalk depends on municipality. The California Vehicle Code says you have to go with traffic. That's the one set of facts that I really strongly dislike, but have you had success fighting that one?
We're dealing with one with a kid right now.
Yeah.
And the argument that we're making is that, one, you're allowed to be on a sidewalk. Two, you're allowed to be on a sidewalk as a kid in this particular municipality. And three, if you look at the strode out there, strode being a derogatory term for a high-speed arterial, that this was the safest place for this child to be on his way to school, and crossing three lanes in one direction, three lanes in the other direction, going 45 miles an hour, he should not have had to go all the way around, do three crossings to get from point A to point B. So there are various tactics to get around it, but I agree with Steve, it's a bad fact.
Yeah, it's really hard. Sidewalk is easier if they're going the wrong way, but they're on the sidewalk. It's a little easier of an argument, but that's really common. I get calls on that all the time. Another one really common is they're on a sidewalk, someone's pulling out of a commercial center, pulls out and hits them, or they hit the car as it's pulling out. That, you look at the municipality, every single one's gonna have different law on that. Hi.
I was going to ask the whole panel, by the way, really impressive panel. I love your passion about it. Curious to know how much overlap everything you guys have discussed as with the scooters / birds.
I have an opinion on that.
If you have an opinion.
Yeah, those are horrible. I mean, they should be completely outlawed. It's insane, right? We have a couple cases with, I was talking to someone earlier with e-bikes. From a rental company, same rental company, three brain injuries, no helmets, okay? And it's crazy. And so I'm going, hey, look, you guys are renting it. You have to, you know, scooters, no. You pick them up on the street, usually drunk. I mean, right? I've seen many attorneys that we all know riding these drunk at these conferences through San Diego. And no, they sign the liability issues. Some of the California Vehicle Code kind of overlaps, but they're super hard cases. I know Simon Law Group has done a couple successfully, but I also know that they're super picky about them. I won't take them. It happened to actually one of my very close friends got a brain injury because I said, you don't have a case. I mean, you're drunk, you hit a curb when you were doing this. I can argue about helmets, but nothing in the law requires that they provide you helmets. So that's a thing that law probably needs to change more than anything, but hard cases, super hard.
Thank you.
Cool.
I'll just mention, if we have a little extra time, that, you know, in any of these cycling cases, one of the biggest defense arguments is always going to be comparative fault. How much can we blame the cyclist for doing something wrong? So in this case, you know, the driver had a stop sign and the cyclist was going down a hill in a residential area, and the vehicle should have stopped at the stop sign, and our cyclist was going, and then he was hit by the car that was making a left. And the driver of the vehicle testifies at our depo, you know, he looked so unsturdy. The bike was shaking. You know, he was tapping his helmet as if he was talking on the phone. So he's talking on his phone, he's looking at his thing, he's shaking, he's going way too fast, he should have seen me, I was already in the intersection. They're gonna always do and say whatever they can to avoid liability and avoid responsibility. So one of the most important things to do is make sure that your client is always credible, is always genuine, and try to find holes in the statements of the defense attorney or the defendant to try to make them realize that they're not telling the truth. You know, it's every single time they say, oh, we weren't on the phone. You don't know that until you actually subpoena the records. We subpoena the cell phone records all the time. And usually it comes with a fight. They're like, but we said we weren't on the phone. Well, subpoena them anyways. And you'll be surprised how many times they're actually on the phone at the time or within a window and small enough to where you can argue with them. And that always helps reduce their credibility. And when you're telling the cyclist that has competed in several of the, what's it called? The Tour de France? Yeah, there you go. He did that tour several times. So you have an avid cyclist that knows how to ride these bikes, that literally has 8 of these bikes at home in his garage, and you're gonna tell him that he was going 20 miles per hour and he was unsturdy and didn't know how to operate his bike? I don't think so. So any comparative fault arguments, I say push the defendant, make sure that you find something that they're lying about, because they're always lying about something. And if you find it, that's going to destroy any comparative fault. That's really just a he said, she said.
I don't have cycling cases where liability is accepted. Maybe when it comes to trial, but I have a case, she literally made an illegal U-turn, going to trial next week. Illegal U-turn over double yellow lines. My guy's just going straight. The cop gave us a little bit of comparative fault, and defense counsel is fighting and asking for 50-50. You're insane. She went over a double yellow line. She stopped in a two lane, was lost, and just turned around and hit a cyclist. But we're dealing with comparative fault. So get to, like everybody says, get to know your client, argue about their experience in riding a bike, and, you know, just get prepared to push back on it.
I'm going to add one thing on this, and that is, it is really, whether it's formal, informal, or talking to people, doing a focus group to get some thematic pieces, it can be really clutch. And I'll give you an example. We did a focus group that we were looking on the damage side, thinking the liability was established. Our cyclist was a bioengineering PhD student at Stanford, and she's coming down a descent up above the Stanford campus. A doctor turns left directly in front of her. She goes flying, orthopedic injuries, brain injury. She is still the smartest person in the room, but less smart than she was before. And so in our focus group, we were shocked. So doctor gets out, says, I am so sorry, this is completely my fault, accepts liability. In the focus group, three of the nine panelists wanted to talk about why it was wrong that the doctor was admitting fault, because she was doing 30 in a 35 mile per hour zone as she was going downhill. Clearly, that is too fast to be going on something this small. So you start hearing some things that make you go, oh shit, what do I do to fix this before I get it in front of a jury?
I'll make one last important point that, you know, if your client is being managed by their primary care doctor, make sure they're being managed by a physician that does personal injury, because it's very important, the screening tools. You have to screen for TBI, PTSD. So if your client is not being seen by somebody who's doing a thorough job, make sure you get them to a physician that can actually do a full screening.
Never forget also that, let's say you have a cycle versus auto car accident case. Never forget to look for other issues of liability. Sometimes we bring product cases against the helmet manufacturer. Sometimes there's something wrong with the helmet. Sometimes there's something wrong with the bike. And on this last case that I mentioned with the defense attorney, we actually brought in the HOA of his community that he was cycling around, because the bush kind of prevented his sight from seeing the car that was turning in front of him. And so we had policy limits from HOA as well as the driver. So never forget to really evaluate. Go out there, look at it yourself, see what's wrong with it, see how the injuries were actually sustained, see what, you know, people could and couldn't see, and really what caused this. And always evaluate the case from multiple sides. Think outside of the box, and I promise you, you'll get a better result.
Great, thank you guys so much.